Good morning, everybody. Before I begin the sermon this morning, we are, Bill and I, in our 42nd year here at Evanston Vineyard. And in my opinion, these are the best years, actually. There were some good things about the beginning years, but these are the best years because you all are here. And that's great. But it is time to start thinking about transition, because I'm not getting any younger. And, you know, as I think about it, you don't want to be the guy who should have quit 2 years ago and is still trying to hang on. You know, and at a certain point, like, the church kind of needs a younger face, a younger brain, you know, somebody with a little more energy. So, you know, it's something that has to be done. And the truth is, we started thinking about this about 5 years ago, and we've read all kinds of books. There's a lot of work that's been done in recent years on how churches can make a transition successfully. So we've gone to conferences and whatnot just to kind of come up with a plan. And we just want to quickly just kind of, I mean, the leaders have all heard this, if you were, or the members, if you were at the members meeting. But if you weren't, we want to just quickly give you like a heads up that we are working on a transition plan. And so the first screen is going to just tell you, here's what we're thinking. How do we anticipate this happening? The first step is going to begin a year from now. So next August, Bill, who is a little bit older than I am, is going to retire. So Bill Hanawalt, who's been sort of my number one associate for the last 42 years, is going to retire. And when he does, we're going to bring in a new associate pastor who is intended to be my successor. So that will go for a year then, and during that year, I'll be the senior pastor. That person will be my senior associate pastor. So we get a year to try to try them on for size. And then the year two, if it goes well, then I and the new person will be co-senior pastors, which means I'll give him all the dirty jobs and just do the bits I like. Yeah, glory, hallelujah, yeah? After 42 years, huh? Okay, then year three, if that goes well. And let me just, let's go back a slide if you can. In year two, that's the point at which we actually make the decision as a congregation. Okay, this is going to be our new senior pastor. We'll make a sort of the final decision at that point. Then we'll go into year three, the last year. The new person will be the senior pastor, and I'll be like the backstop, just, you know, I don't know, petering out in the last year. We'll have to negotiate exactly what that looks like and who does what. Part of the idea, of course, is that by the time I'm gone, you're used to the new person, and it doesn't feel like, you know, like it doesn't feel as dislocating or strange, okay? And now, you might want to know, like, well, all right, who are we looking for? Because we are already looking. And just a quick rundown of what we're looking for. We're looking for somebody who's in the Vineyard movement and is thoroughly committed to the Vineyard movement. Those of you who are newer here might not understand that a really important part of who we are and who we have become was becoming a part of the Vineyard movement, which God called us to in a supernatural way. So that's kind of non-negotiable. So it's got to be somebody within our family of churches, because we're part of a family of churches called the Vineyard. It's got to be somebody there. Number two, we're looking for somebody who has at least 8 years of experience in top-level leadership. Like, this is, like, not a church for a newbie. You know, like, you don't want to have to deal with somebody who's going to take 10 years to figure out, like I did, how to actually lead a church. You know, we kind of spent the first 10 years practicing, and of course it was a little church then, and little churches don't have much choice. But now we are a bigger church. You know, we want somebody who's going to be able to hit the ground running, who understands how this works. All right, number three. We're looking for somebody who has the ability to think and lead strategically, theologically, and practically, which are important combinations for the church to move forward into the future. We're not just looking for somebody who's going to maintain the status quo. We're looking for somebody who will move us forward into the next generation, because our goal is to have a church that lasts for more than one generation. I'm hoping for at least three or four. You know, so it's partly up to you, especially those of you who are younger, to fulfill my dream. I won't be around to see it all, but that's what we're hoping for. And we're looking for somebody who's able to put at least 20 years into building this church into that next generation, all right? Because we don't want to have another transition 5 years from now, because it's really difficult and it's hard to reset. So we want somebody who's got a good long run, because the truth is, great churches are built by long pastorates. And you just got to be there a long time to actually make a difference. So that's number four. And number five, we're looking for a person who's a person of color or has experience with cultural or racial diversity, because that's who we are. When we started 42 years ago, we were all just white people, okay? And so that's what we were. But God has intervened, surprised us, and changed us so that now we are people from all different kind of backgrounds and all different races, from 55 different nations of the world. So the new person has to be able to come in and be a pastor for everybody that's coming in here. So we're looking for somebody who's got the ability. And the sad truth is that makes our pool very small of people who have that experience, because this is just not the norm in church life in America. But it's non-negotiable. It's got to be that. And then lastly, number six has a commitment. No, this isn't last. But number six has a commitment to the historical values of Sabina. They need to kind of be in touch with who we are. We're not going to, like, change the essentials of who we are. So all the reasons why you're here and why you love this church, we're planning to keep those reasons. All right, number seven. Lastly, has clear signs that God is supernaturally calling them to lead this church. That's what we're looking for. Like, not just somebody who meets our little list, but actually somebody that God picked is what we're looking for. We want to have a sense that that's the way it is. So that's what we're looking for. We expect to choose that person in the next couple months, okay? And we'll invite them to come in to be an associate pastor, and then we'll all get to, like, be with them starting next year for a year, and then we'll make a decision as a congregation, yeah, this is the right person. Okay, that's how it's going to go. And that kind of gives you a basic idea. If you have questions, you can ask me or ask some of the church council members who will be a part of making that decision. All right, on to the message. When I was 12 years old, I discovered ambition. Not like a child is dreaming of, one day I'd like to be whatever, but I mean like ambition. Passionate, determined, focused, unrelenting ambition. What was my ambition? To get rich. It seemed at the time like most everybody I knew had more stuff than my family did, and I wanted more stuff. Somebody gave my mother some issues of Better Homes and Gardens. And I would go through them and look at the house parts. I didn't really care much about the garden part, but I would go through and look at the house part and cut out pictures of the most fabulous homes so that I could look at them and determine that one day I would have a home like that. And I decided that the way to get rich was to go to the best university, get the best grades, become the best high-flying lawyer, and thereby make lots of money. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the legal profession, But my reasons for pursuing it were entirely selfish. There was not even a shred of serving the public in my ambition. It was all about just getting rich. And from then on, from 12 years old on, through middle school and high school, every assignment, every test was for me just one more step towards achieving my ambition. Like, it never left my mind, day or night. Sometime in my senior year, I actually one day just passed out in the hallway at school from exhaustion because I was pushing myself so hard. I was ambitious. Well, as you can see, it didn't work out. I'm driving a Honda Fit and I live in an apartment. I did make good grades. I did go to a good college. But when I was in college, I discovered something so much better than money that I forgot all about my puny and selfish ambition. I discovered what I would call good ambition. Now, generally, ambition has gotten a bad rap, mostly because of the crimes of people ambitious for power or wealth who hurt other people along the way. And there's a very long list. I saw one article in a Christian publication titled, "Why You Must Kill Your Ambitions." That's kind of how most people think about it. You should kill your ambition. Don't be ambitious. But you know, if you actually look in the dictionary, ambition is simply the strong desire to achieve something. Now, as human beings, we're made to achieve. If you read the Bible, like the first chapters in the book of Genesis, God says we're to master creation. There's a lot of achievement in mastering creation. We're still working on it. So we're made to have a certain kind of ambition. The alternative to ambition would be passivity or fatalism, which is no way to live, and it's less than we are meant to be as image bearers of God, who is the ultimate in creation and creativity. Whether ambition is good or bad, I think pretty much depends on what the object of your ambition is. Ambition that is selfish in nature easily becomes bad ambition. But there are other kinds of ambition. There is such a thing, I propose, as good ambition, and that's what today's lesson is all about. We're doing this series called Eating Well, where we're reading together through the Bible, and this week we're at the end of 1 Timothy, which is a letter written by the Apostle Paul to his disciple, a young man named Timothy, and Timothy is leading a church as a young man, and Paul is giving him advice. And we're going to pick up in 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning at verse 6. A godly life brings huge profits to people who are content with what they have. We didn't bring anything into the world, and we can't take anything out of it. As long as we have food and clothes, we should be satisfied. But people who want to get rich keep falling into temptation. They are trapped by many stupid and harmful desires which drown them in destruction and ruin. Certainly the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people who have set their hearts on getting rich have wandered away from the Christian faith and have caused themselves a lot of grief. But you, man of God, must avoid these things. Pursue what God approves of, a godly life, faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. Fight the good fight for the Christian faith. Take hold of everlasting life to which you were called and about which you made a good testimony in front of many witnesses. In the sight of God, who gives life to everything, And in the sight of Christ Jesus, who gave a good testimony in front of Pontius Pilate, I insist that until our Lord Jesus Christ appears, you obey this command completely. Then you cannot be blamed for doing anything wrong. At the right time, God will make this known. God is the blessed and only ruler. He is the King of kings and Lord of lords. He is the only one who cannot die. He lives in light that no one can come near. No one has seen him, nor can they see him. Honor and power belong to him forever. Amen. Let those who have the riches of this world tell those who have the riches of this world not to be arrogant and not to place their confidence in anything as uncertain as riches. Instead, they should place their confidence in God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Tell them to do good, to do a lot of good things, to be generous, and to share. And by doing this, they store up a treasure for themselves, which is a good foundation for the future. And in this way, they take hold of what life really is. Now, the problem is that many people don't understand what a good life really is. That was my problem when I was 12. I didn't get it. And the problem with people who don't understand what a good life really is that they're never happy. They connive and they struggle. They may even cheat and lie to get more. More money, more power, more status. But it's never enough. And they're not happy. Oh, they might be able to cover up their misery for short periods of time with all kinds of expensive entertainment. But they're actually not happy because they don't know what the good life really is. But once we find Jesus, that starts to change. He starts showing us and leading us into the truly good life. And so here in this passage, we have some useful instructions on how to live the truly good life by discovering good ambition. Now, the first thing we see here is that the good life is a life of contentment. There are huge profits, he says, to be gained by being content with what you have. Contentment begins with recognizing that we didn't bring anything into the world and we won't take anything out of it. You came in broke and you're going to go out broke. Having food and clothing during our time here is enough. Nobody ever says on their deathbed, "I wish I'd made more money." Or, "I wish I had a bigger house." When your physical body is about to occupy a box in the ground that's about 6 feet by 3, money and houses are just pretty much meaningless. That's not what you're thinking about. You know, one of our vineyard pastors here in the Chicagoland area was attacked and stabbed about 10 years ago. And as he describes it, he thought he was about to die as he was struggling with this guy to fend off this guy with the knife who was stabbing him and yelling, "You must die." And in that moment, all he could think about, he thought, "This is it, I'm going to die." And all he cared about in that moment, he says, was love. Like, that was what was in his mind. How have I done at loving the people in my life? He had not a second's thought about how much money he had or how big his salary was, nor even about how big his church was. None of it mattered. Just love. Miraculously, he survived, but he was a different man afterwards. You know, when you're content, you have mental and emotional space for love. Got that? When you're content, you have the mental and emotional space for love. When you're not content, when you're driven for more and more and more, it's hard to stop and love, let alone enjoy the goodness of each day and the creation around us. This week, earlier in the week, when we had the nice weather, I was walking my 6-year-old grandson home from school. Like many children his age, he is wonderfully content. He's got all he needs. And he's able to enjoy the little things in life. And it was a beautiful day. And so on the way home, we walked past this lawn with a whole bunch of dandelions, many of which had developed into puffballs. Now, when I had a house with a lawn, dandelions were my nemesis. Like, I would have been out there, like, trying to dig them all up. But on this day, dandelions were a delight. And so he spent time along the way picking dandelions and blowing the puffballs. And as he blew those puffballs, I was filled with contentment and joy just watching him enjoy that moment. That's just some of the profit to be gained from contentment. People who are content get along better with everybody. They're more able to be generous, more able to handle problems without freaking out. The less likely to get into debt, more likely to spend life smiling and laughing. There are huge profits to be found in a life of contentment. Ambition can either hurt that good life or it can enhance the good life. Now, in the second paragraph, the apostle moves on from the profit of contentment to the dangers for those who want to get rich. This is where the famous saying, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, comes from. It doesn't say the love of money is all kinds of evil, but it's the root from which other evils come. The problem is not with being rich. It doesn't say that. It's the love is the problem. There are clearly rich people who are part of the church he's writing to. Okay, because at the end, he like has some things to say to the people who are rich. You know, that's not the problem. The problem is the word love. When you love, what you love easily becomes your ambition. And if your ambition is money, that's selfish ambition. It will not lead to contentment or the good life. Selfish ambition works against a good life. First, trying to put our confidence in what can not give either confidence or contentment. Why do people want to be rich? So they can be independent. So they can be comfortable. So they can be secure. So they can be confident. So they can get their way. So they can impress people. But in the end, money and possessions are inherently insecure. A change in government, a disaster, a depression can destroy it all in short order. Really, it becomes like an idol to replace God. Those who want to be rich are wanting to put their confidence in something other than depending upon God. Second, there's the emotional pursuit of more. When your ambition is selfish for money or power or status, there's never enough. You always want more. Someone once asked oil tycoon J. Paul Getty, at one time the richest man in the world, how much money is enough? And he replied, a little bit more. When his grandson and namesake was kidnapped, he refused to pay. He also famously put pay telephones in his mansion so the guests had to pay for their telephone calls. A little bit more. The grandson was eventually ransomed for a much smaller amount after having his ear cut off and undergoing horrible torture. The grandson subsequently became addicted to drugs until the drugs gave him a stroke that made him a quadriplegic, and he died in his early 50s, and all the money in the world couldn't save him. That's where a little bit more goes. It leads us, he says, to all kinds of evil. It's pretty much led to every kind of evil known to man. History is full of the evil that comes from selfish ambition, stealing, murder, adultery, etc. Many lives, many families, even nations have been destroyed out of selfish ambition. It leads to fear and worry. When all your confidence is based on something that can be lost, stolen, or destroyed in some way, then it's likely that a lot of your life is going to be filled with protecting yourself from the people who would take it, fear and worry. And it causes us, most importantly, to miss the truly important things and therefore encounter many griefs.
You spend all your time pursuing your selfish ambition during the years your children are growing up, only to end their days wishing their children would spend more time with them. Selfish ambition can lead you to sacrifice all the most important people in your life to the point where you are old and alone. That's the classic story of Ebenezer Scrooge in Dickens' Christmas Carol, where Ebenezer Scrooge gives his life over to the love of money and ends up with no friends and no family. And he says it leads to the loss of faith because selfish ambition crowds out everything else. Being the worship of an idol, it often leads to a loss of faith. As Jesus said, you can't serve both God and money. That doesn't mean you can't have money, but you can't serve it. Number 7, it leads, he says, to destruction and ruin. There's a guy named Khalid Hosseini who wrote the book The Kite Runner, who also wrote a short story about a man who found a magic cup, and he learned that if he wept into the cup, his tears turned into pearls. But even though he had always been poor, he was a happy man and rarely shed a tear. So he found ways to make himself sad so that his tears could make him rich. As the pearls piled up, so did his greed grow. He needed more. And the story ended with the man sitting on a mountain of pearls, knife in hand, weeping helplessly into the cup with his beloved wife's slain body in his arms. All that, of course, is why ambition has gotten a bad reputation. But there is another kind of ambition, good ambition, and the apostle moves on from the dangers of selfish ambition to urge us, and he uses these words, pursue, fight, take hold of. These are not words of passive acceptance. No, these are strong words. Pursue, fight, take hold of. Words about ambition. A different kind of ambition, a good ambition. To take hold of what life really is meant to be, the truly good life. So good ambition leads to the best life. What is it? Well, he tells us. First of all, as you read the description, the beginning of good ambition is the desire not for things, but to be a certain kind of person. The things we are to pursue are first about what kind of person we are. We should have as our ambition to be people who are godly, full of faith, love, endurance, and gentleness. In other words, people who are like Jesus. To be godly is to be like him and to live life with Jesus at the center of your life. That's a good ambition to have. Every day, each one of you sitting here today is becoming a person shaped by your ambition. What kind of person are you becoming? Second, good ambition is the desire to prepare for the next life. He says, we are called to and destined for life everlasting. This life is meant to be a time of preparation for that life. And wise people prepare for what is coming. We should make our ambition to prepare, he says, by being generous and doing good. It appears you can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead by being generous. And three, good ambition is the desire to live a life truly worth living. He says, by doing good, we will take hold of a life truly worth living. I've found in my life that a simple commitment to do good in any way I can has led to a joyful life of peace and contentment with plenty to do and little anxiety. Mostly, I just say to God, you know, you show me the good I can do and I'll do it. And he lays it out, and I do good here, there, and everywhere. And I don't have to become something except a person that does good as God provides. You know, there are basically two kinds of people in this world. There are the takers, and there are the givers. And those who are givers have found the best deal by far. So we who follow Christ should make it our ambition to be the world's best givers. You don't have to be rich to be a giver. It's not even about necessarily money. It's just about being your attitude to daily life. Am I going to give in some way to somebody today? Even if it's nothing more than sitting in your chair or lying in your bed and praying, you're still giving. That is what good ambition looks like. When I found good ambition, I threw away selfish ambition like a smelly bit of garbage. Why should I waste my life pursuing selfish ambition when I can have the joys of good ambition starting right now? I can still remember the exact moment. There was an actual moment in my life where it dawned on me, like, this thing I've been pursuing since since 12 years old is garbage, and I have a better option. Somebody had given me a ride home from a Bible study. I was getting out of the car, and as I got out of the car, I thought to myself, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And I thought, if I could have this, a big bank account or a big house, doesn't matter. I just want this. I want the good ambition. And that's how it's been ever since. That sent me on the path that's landed me standing here today. So how can we get good ambition? Number one, he says, consider the shortness of life. The apostle points out that God is the only one who cannot die. We will all die and pass into the next life, ready or not. Perhaps tomorrow, perhaps in old age, but it all comes pretty fast in any case. Life is short, and so we should make it our ambition to live life in a way that will leave no regrets at the end. Second, consider that you will be accountable to Jesus. One day, you will stand before the God who gives life to everything, who is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who lives in unapproachable light, and you will be standing in front of him. Even the angels fall down and worship him with trembling. And when you stand before him, all will be revealed. Your true ambition will be clear to all, and what will you say to him on that day? Will you be ashamed, or will you be joyful? Remember, that day is coming, and that can shape your ambitions and move you towards good ambition. Number three, you can build good ambition by cultivating generosity. How do you cultivate generosity? By giving away. Giving away. Begin by supporting the financial needs of the church, but true generosity is much more than that. It's about sharing your time, sharing your home, giving away what you can to those in need. It's about serving with humility. You know, I'd like to tell you, there are some quiet heroes in this church that, in my opinion, are living examples of the practice and the power of generosity, true generosity. I'm thinking of several families in our church who've taken into their homes and into their families and into their love children in need of a home, children in trouble through no fault of their own. It's not easy, but it speaks to me so powerfully. As I look at them taking in these kids, it speaks to me so powerfully about Jesus, who has made a home in heaven for me and for you. And I got to say, I am so proud that that is becoming just one of those things that Vineyard people do. Like, it's like spreading. Like, we take unwanted children. We could put a sign up front. Unwanted children wanted here. The rest of the world may throw them away or treat them like criminals, but we take them in and love them as our own. Want to change lives? Want to change the world? Then cultivate a life of generosity through serving and giving of your time, energy, and money. Let it become radical generosity, if not as a parent to children in need, then in some other way. What would it say to the world if all God's people everywhere cultivated that kind of generosity? Number four, and finally, learn contentment regarding the things of this life. When you learn contentment, you're more able to focus on good ambition. Want to be more content? Start with the daily practice of gratitude to God for all the things you do have. Just like thank God every day. I got a place to live, I got clothes, I got food, okay? Then find a way to serve people who have less than you in some way. It will help you be more content with what you have. Look more closely at the lives of people who seem to have more than you and see whether it's giving them a really better life or not. Pray for your needs and stay out of debt. If you're struggling with debt, take our FPU small group course. They'll fix you up, and you'll be a lot more content, and you won't be in debt by the time they're done. All those things will bring more contentment, free you up for good ambition. And so I encourage you, let's pursue our best ambitions. You know, a few years ago, I was speaking at a conference in England, and they had also invited a pretty well-known Presbyterian pastor from the state of Virginia. And he spent the week, and this is the first time he'd been around any kind of vineyard people, spent the week there speaking and then just talking to different vineyard pastors and leaders. And he went back to his church and gave a report that I went online and listened to. And what he said was, the most amazing thing about the vineyard people was that they had an instinct for the greatest suffering. Like, their instinct was always, let's find the most suffering and let's go there and help. Let's find the place where there's the greatest need, let's go there and help. And that's what amazed him about the vineyard people, was that person after person after person had this thing in them, this ambition in them. We want to be the ones that go to the hardest places, where the most suffering is, and like bring light in the darkest places. I love that. So let's go after it with all our might. Let's fight for it. Let's take hold of it so that we might live a life truly worth living in this life and in the next. Let's stand and respond to God in song.